sharing your wisdom with us.
All right. Well, I don't know about wisdom, but I'll share something with you. So the first thing I'm going to do, everybody, before I get started, is launch. We have a poll, which Lisa kindly typed in for me before we got started, because for some reason I didn't have the poll option. This is just going to let me know a little bit about what my audience is like, and you know, what I should emphasize. All right, so I'm going to hit launch. Hopefully you guys can all see the poll now. So the first question is, how many years have you been teaching? That's pretty straightforward. What discipline area are you in? That's pretty straightforward. And then, what would you most like to hear about? I'll talk about it in just a second. I guess maybe I'll talk about it now, and then you can go ahead and vote. So I'm going to start out sort of just generally introducing the idea of why we do evaluation. That's what I'm calling philosophy. Then talk a little bit about how the students' backgrounds might impact evaluation, some little bit about practical evaluation applications, and a little bit about technology, although I will warn you that I am not a highly technical person. Okay, so we have a bunch of quite experienced teachers. There's still people voting, so I'll just wait another second or another few seconds. But people who haven't voted have a chance. Oh, and Sarah, hi, Sarah. You're up there somewhere. Someone in the audience who knows me.
I think there's more than one that know you, Dr. Dixon. You have followers.
Well, I see two. Three, at least three. All right, so yeah, there's a couple of people still to vote. I'll have a quick drink. So it looks like in terms of teaching, we have a kind of a bimodal distribution. With most people, with about half of the audience being pretty experienced teachers, and then, you know, a number who are not so experienced, and then in the middle fewer. We have a pretty even distribution across different areas, not no one in fine arts. Okay, so then I can use fine arts examples, and no one will call me out on it. And, you know, a lot of votes for practical application, and then, you know, more moderate votes for other things. Okay, great. I am going to start sharing my slides now. I don't know if people can see this. So I'm sharing the results. So you guys can see that now, hopefully. Sorry, this is one of the issues with Zoom is that, come on, there we go. Can you see my slides?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yeah, they're kind of small, or is that just me?
No, now they should be big.
Okay, yeah.
They were just not in slideshow yet. All right. Okay. So I'm just looking to see if anything has drastically changed in the thing. Nope, not particularly. All right. So let's go ahead and get started. I'm going to open the chat back up. So if people chat, hopefully I will see it. I can't see any of you now, so I'm talking into a void. But if you have questions, feel free to type in the chat. If I miss it, hopefully Lisa or Fong will catch it. Okay, so what I'm gonna talk to you about today is, gonna start talking generally about evaluation, then move into sort of some issues of why you might wanna think about the types of evaluations you do, particularly high stakes versus low stakes. and then talk a little bit about some practical applications of this in what I sort of basically what I do in my courses. Okay. So this is the basic structure of the talk. I'm going to talk about why we're going to do this in the first place, talk about some different types. This is going to be pretty quick. We'll go through these things, the introductory stuff, fairly rapidly. And then I'm going to focus a little bit on thinking about when you design a test or any other type of assignment, using what's called backwards design to create it. I'm going to talk a little bit about this is where the low stakes versus high stakes come in. Talk a little bit about how, in particular, high stakes tests appear to have different impacts on different groups of students. Talk a little bit about some practical considerations in terms of setting up different types of evaluations. A little bit about online versus face-to-face and how those things are different. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about my experience with here at FSU actually trying to create or think about how to evaluate students for skills across a really wide range of fields. I'm going to give you actually a mini lecture force you to learn a tiny bit of biology and sort of talk about coming up with a sample evaluation. And at the end, very quickly show you what I do in terms of an online one. Okay, so that's where we're going to go. We're going to sort of be more interactive. We're going to be interactive the whole way through. We're going to try and be the most interactive here where we think about what we might do for a sample evaluation. Okay, so I'm going to ask now, and you guys can answer. Typically what I do in class is I allow students to answer either by turning their microphone on and speaking or by typing something in the chat. Either is fine. I largely do that because lots of students like using chat, so I get a lot more feedback that way. So why, when we teach a class, why do we do an evaluation? Why don't we just teach the class and say, okay, you guys have learned it, off you go.
I think we, hi, my name is Honoree.
Hi.
Yes. I think we use evaluation because, to me, I see it as a way to improve my teaching because what I think might work great does not always work for the students, and I teach for the students and not for myself. So it's important to make sure that the students are getting what I want as an instructor. Some questions are about, do you think the assignments are graded in a timely manner? And so I think that's important that students think that yes, they are, because it's important for them to get feedback. Just as an example.
All right. So that's a really great answer. Thank you for that. And then a couple of other people have said that we've got quite a few answers here. to measure progress, to assess whether the students are learning, so the students and the instructors can see how things stand in terms of students learning, to make sure the students are learning, to ensure that their material has been effectively communicated and understood, and helps the students think critically about the material if done properly, okay? So you guys have touched on all three of the things that I was gonna say in terms of why do it. And so I don't know if many of you have probably heard these terms before. So when we talk about assessment, we talk about formative and summative. And then also there's this issue of instructor feedback, which was what the thing that was mentioned first, and several other people mentioned this too, is that it's, you don't really know if you're teaching students effectively unless you have some way of judging what they've learned, okay? So it's very useful for you. And I'm gonna come back to that point, it's the point of instructor feedback when we get to the talking about the low stakes stuff, okay? Then formative versus summative. Does anyone know what is meant by those two things in this context? All right. Well, I'll just go ahead and answer this one. It's a kind of a minor one. So A formative assessment is something that's really designed to help students learn. So it's not so much that that you're testing them on something or, you know, assessing whether they already know something, but it's the idea is that it will help them learn. So if you asked a student to write, for example, a paper on a particular topic, yes, they're very, very, thank you. So if you asked the students to write a paper on a topic, then presumably they would know more about it at the end than they did at the start. Whereas in a final exam, you'd expect that to be mostly summative, because that's the idea there is you're assessing what the students have actually learned, what they could do that they couldn't do previously. Okay, so that's, and so the, both of those things are really valid goals of an assessment. Now, I would say that almost all assessments are actually somewhat formative. There's been a lot of research showing that students actually know more, they understand the material better after they take an exam than before, even if they didn't do very well on the exam. Like just the action of actually taking the exam, thinking about the questions and stuff, it will actually help them learn, okay? So pretty much all assignments, I would say, are to some extent formative, but some are more so than others, and some are not at all summative, and some are. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of talk about, you know, what I try and do in my classes is have a sort of an ongoing series of assignments that are kind of a mixture of both of these things, and also giving me feedback. All jointly, okay? All right, so now, I'm gonna think in a more practical sense, and what I'm gonna do now is just say there's a lot of different things you can do, obviously, and I've come up with a list here. There's probably gonna be a lot more things that I haven't thought of. So you have exams, so larger scale tests, you have quizzes, short tests, you have homework, like problem-based kind of things where students have to work something out. You have research papers where, you know, they could either be things based on the literature in your field, or you go out and actually gather data for the paper. There are oral presentations. There are a wide range of different types of projects. You know, if you were in music, there would be performance, for example, as well. So there's lots of different things you can do. And so I'm not really going to focus on this much in this talk. This is kind of a huge topic here. But one of the things you do want to think about is what you're doing an appropriate tool for your goals? And so that's what I'm going to really focus in on is the first thing you should do when you're thinking about evaluation is thinking about what the goals are. What do you want the students to be able to do? What do you want to assess whether they can do it or not? What do you want this to teach them how to do? Okay, which is my next topic. Okay, so goals and backwards design. Anyone here heard the term backwards design before in terms of education? And care to maybe say or type out what they think it means? No. Okay. So that's good to know that someone doesn't know. Okay. So backwards design basically is the idea that when you're designing something, whether it's in education, whether it's an evaluation or what you do in the classroom, is you want to start out not thinking about what am I going to do, but you want to think about what do you want to have as the result at the end. Okay, so if you're thinking about a classroom experience, you know, you have 50 minutes with your students, rather than start out thinking, okay, I'm going to, you know, we're going to cover these things, you should be thinking about what are the objectives for this block of time, this set of slides, whatever it is you have, and think, what do you want the students to be able to do at the beginning that they couldn't do before, okay, in terms of things, and then think, well, okay, how can I get them there, okay? So that's why it's called backwards. You think about what you want to have happen at the end, and then you work backwards, rather than starting out saying, okay, I am going to do a slideshow about this, you know, you think, what do I want them to do, and then work backwards, okay? So I'm going to talk about a little bit about how that might look in an assessment, okay? So if it's a formative assessment, so thinking about something in my own field, this might be something like a lab exercise, for example, but it could be, you know, really something very different. Is that you say, okay, what do I want students to be able to do at the end of it? And so then you might say, well, I want them, if it was, say, an example, a lab, I might say, I want them to be able to interpret this kind of data, to generate and interpret this kind of data. Like they would do a particular analysis in the lab, they would get some data, they would make a graph of it, and they could be able to explain what it means, okay? So those, and I would have that written out as a very discrete set of things. And so then I would say, okay, the end product then has got to demonstrate to me that that they can do that, okay? And so one of the crucial things is that when you create those objectives, and we'll go through an example of this in a little bit so you can see what that looks like, is that you tell the students what those are too. And I must confess that I'm guilty of not always doing that. But if you tell the students what the goals are, then, you know, they can work towards those goals, okay? That will help them out and it will help you out. So you create your list of things you want the students to be able to do. You tell the students what those things are. You then say, okay, well, I'm now going to design, in this case, my lab exercise, but it could also be quiz questions, it could be instructions for writing a paper, whatever it is. I will create an assessment that I think is going to accomplish this, that it's going to accomplish this. And then when you get the results, then if you have a clear idea in mind of what you want the students to be able to do, and you can see, yes, they did it, or no, they didn't, then you can adjust. So you can say, okay, you know, this lab didn't work so well this year, let's do something different next year, or let's do something next week, because it's clear they didn't understand this, okay? So what I've written for summative is really basically the same, except I don't have the review results and adjust. And so the difference here is that in the formative, this is an ongoing process. And so if the students aren't really, you know, getting what you want them to get, then you can adjust it and move forwards. Okay. Okay. So at this point, have I confused anybody? Anybody want me to stop? This has mostly been the sort of introductory part. I am going to point out to Lisa now that I actually, when I have my slideshow on, I have no idea what time it is. So if I start going really long, let me know, please.
No problem.
Okay.
You have an hour left.
I have an hour left. Well, yes, I wasn't really worried that I was going to run out of time right now, but I just, I thought I should let you know and say, you know, I really, that's actually one of the issues here is that when in slideshow in Zoom, I cannot see my clock on my computer. I'm having issues with my phone, so I have it turned off. So as far as I know, I mean, I could talk for an enormously long time. So please don't let me, because I don't want all these nice people who came to see me, hear me talk, to hate me afterwards.
No problem.
Okay. All right. So that's sort of my introductory spiel about why you want to do evaluations and, you know, what you might want to think about when you're designing them. And now I'm going to get into this like high stakes, low stakes thing. Okay. So what do we mean by that? So a high stakes evaluation, I don't know if there's any cutoff really for this, but it basically means that there's a something that has a really substantial effect on your grade in the course or something. And it has a big, this one thing has a big effect. So make or break. So, you know, you do this exam, this means you're going to get an A or you're going to get a C or something. So examples of these outside of classes are things like the GRE and other kinds of standardized tests. Comprehensive exams that you have to take in grad school would be, these are all examples of really high stakes things, okay? And so I hadn't really thought of this before, but my understanding is, and you know, I was a pre-college student a really long time ago, and in Canada rather than in the U.S. So my experience of this is pretty different than younger people would have had. But my understanding is that there's really an increased emphasis in recent years in K through 12 on, you know, these sort of high stakes standardized tests. Okay, and in contrast, there is a decreased, I think, emphasis over, you know, probably a longer period of time on high stakes tests in undergraduate education. And now this is basically just on my own experience, so it could be wrong. But I mean, I know when I was an undergraduate, which again was a really long time ago. Angela says a lot of my graduate courses have high stakes assignments. I hate it. Yes. So it's generally not a good thing. So like when I was an undergraduate, it was not uncommon for me to have a final exam that might be worth say 30 to 35% of my grade, okay? That would be very rare in undergraduate science courses, at least in my experience, that you would have an exam. I typically would have courses that had a single midterm and a final. The courses I teach now, I teach introductory biology, they typically have three tests and a final. So the scores are, that each individual one is worth a lot less than it was before. And I've noticed students still tend to be fairly anxious about them. So what's the issue here? Why is this a bad thing? Well, Angela pointed out a bad thing is that, you know, if you just happen to have a bad day when you're doing one of these, it can have a big impact, right? So you just, you know, you get sick, and rather than sort of calling in sick, you decide to go and take the exam anyways, which was what students often do, and then they don't do very well. It's not a good thing. But there are other reasons besides that that it can be a bad thing, okay? And so I'm gonna sort of link this now to some sort of, you know, social issues and education. So again, have people heard of the term stereotype threat before? I'm sure some of you have. Yes, some people have. Okay. So I'm assuming some of you haven't. So the idea of stereotype threat is that if you're a member of an underrepresented group in a particular field, and so if you're in science, that probably means, especially if you're in hard sciences like physics or chemistry or engineering, that would mean pretty much anyone that it's not a white male. Then, you know, one of the things that can happen is that when you come to take tests and things, you have this extra stress as not just representing yourself, but representing the group to which you are part of, okay? And then this is kind of a sort of documented thing. That this can put additional stress on people and often cause increased test anxiety and maybe poor performance, okay? And so here's an example looking at performance on, you know, a particular test where you just tell the students different things at the beginning, okay? And so if you tell them that, you know, there's no gender differences been found in this test, men and women perform equally well, then in fact you find men and women do tend to perform pretty equally well on it. Whereas if you say this test usually produces a gender difference, then you see a big difference in performance. Okay. And so here are a couple of other examples, not having to do with one having to do with race and one having to do with gender. And so what you're seeing here is if you frame the test in different ways, you get very different responses. So if you frame the test in the context of being able to speak well, you see a pronounced difference between white and black students. If you just frame it as a class exercise, they perform basically the same. If you phrase it in terms of being able to do math, you see a pronounced gender difference. If you phrase it in terms of problem solving, then you don't, okay? I just put these up as examples. I actually don't really know much about these specific examples, but this has been documented in a number of different situations. So why am I bringing this up in terms of high stakes and low stakes? Well, because of this, and I'm sorry, this graph is really gonna be really hard to read, but there's only one thing you need to pay attention to on it. So this is looking at the, this paper was primarily looking at the effects of class size, whether you had big or small classes and how that affected the grades of male and female students. But one of the things that's interesting here is that if you, especially at the big class size end, like you would have in most introductory science classes, you would have really big classes. What you see is a difference between male and female students, and they've blown this up so you can see it here, in terms of exam grades, but really no difference in terms of non-exam grades. And so there seems to be this effect, and there have been a number of papers on this looking specifically at male versus female differences, is that, you know, that a lot of the, pretty much all the performance difference that you would see in these classes is based on exams and not on other work, okay? And this is, again, is gonna be, I'm sorry, a little hard to read, but this is looking at sort of a model based on a bunch of data, looking at performance on exams, which is the circles over here on each of these little funny little figures, and performance on assignments other than exams, okay? And so what you see here, and then they use the ACT as basically sort of a measure of the student's baseline knowledge, and then looked at that, how that interacts through interest and test anxiety to affect their performance on exams, okay? And then so we have males at the bottom, females on the top. And so really the important thing to note here is that for females, for female students, their ACT, so how well they had done prior to this, has very little effect on their test anxiety. So that, you know, the fact that they did well in the past or they didn't do well doesn't really seem to affect their test anxiety, but their test anxiety has a big effect on their exam performance, okay? For males, it's the opposite. Their test anxiety is largely a function of how well they did in the past, but that doesn't seem to affect their exam performance. You see the same pattern for non-exam performance, but actually the size of the effect is a lot smaller, okay? So what you seem to be seeing here is that female students are, you know, they have test anxiety, probably from a feeling that maybe they don't belong in this situation. And it doesn't seem to really matter how well they were doing before they came in. And it does have an impact on their exam performance. It also seems to maybe have a much smaller effect on non-exam performance, but that's a much smaller thing. And if you remember the last slide, there wasn't really a difference between men and women in non-exam performance, and there is an exam performance. So this whole idea that different groups of students are impacted differently by, you know, the sort of undergraduate experience, you know, the way that they're taught, the types of evaluations that you give, you know, makes people really think, you know, how should you test people in a way that's fair and how should you teach people in a way that's fair, which is really a topic that I'm not gonna talk about now, is how you would teach, but how you would test. And so I'm part of a sort of inter-university group called EduSTEM that is sort of trying to look at student attitudes largely in introductory science classes to see, like, if I look at things like their level of anxiety, if they feel like they belong in the class, and so on, and how that affects their performance in the class. And one of the things we were encouraged to do was to, as based on the sort of data that I just talked about, is try and reduce the number of high stakes things in our classes, the number of high stakes evaluations. Okay. So that's kind of the context. All right, so I want to just talk very briefly, now that I've given you some background, to talk about where we're going, is talk to you a little bit about practical considerations, okay? So when you're testing, student backgrounds are obviously an important thing. The other important thing, which I put an exclamation point by, is grading, okay? So why do you think I've put grading up there as such a big thing? But grading takes a lot of time, okay? And if you have a big class, and you know, I should have actually asked you guys that at the beginning, maybe as a fourth survey question, is ask you how large the classes are that you teach. I teach a lot of really big classes, which means investing huge amounts of time in grading is not very practical. And so the thing is that you can evaluate students in a very detailed way. For example, if I ask them complex questions where they have to write out answers, that will tell me more about them than if I just ask them to fill in the blank or something like that. But this is always going to be a sort of trade-off, right? You have to sort of balance how much time and effort you have to do whatever tasks you're going to do with what you're going to do. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you about my approach, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the pros and cons with that in mind. Okay. So I'm assuming a lot of you guys have been teaching online, and a lot of you have taught in person in the past. At this point, I haven't done it enough that I can say that I think there's a really huge difference between the evaluation part of it online and doing it in person for the kinds of courses that I teach. For certain types of things, obviously it would be, but evaluation doesn't strike me as that thing. I teach public speaking, big difference. Yes, so I did have students in one of my classes have to give talks. So they have to give talks over Zoom. So yeah, you can't really give them nearly as detailed feedback about their speaking when they're talking to you. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna point out a few things. So personalized feedback is obviously harder when you're teaching online. The students are submitting work over the internet. And so it's a lot, you can write everything out, but you can't really, it's harder to talk to them in the same way. You have more technical issues. So you have, you more often might have issues with being able to do something just because of a technical problem. So for example, if students need to give talks and they don't have a camera, for example, so you can't see them, that would be an example of a technical problem. I know the one thing that people are the most concerned about in my department of teaching online is academic honesty. Because again, you have a lot less control over what the students are doing. And I'm going to sort of talk, as I talk about my approach to this, about things that you can do to minimize issues of academic dishonesty without being really intrusive. Okay. This I'm really just going to mention because I don't actually have any experience with asynchronous teaching. So these are the two approaches you can do when you're doing an online thing, is you do synchronous, where you're meeting with your class live and talking to them, and asynchronous, you just prepare, you know, you re-record everything and students do it on their own time. In terms of the way you do evaluation, there's not going to be a huge difference there, except for stuff that you would do live in the classroom, which is, in my courses, that's a relatively minimal amount. But I can see in other things like public speaking, that might be bigger. Okay. Let's take a break for a second. So one of the things to, you know, to think about is when you're doing evaluations is, you know, what are the appropriate tools for your field, which you would obviously know more about than I do if you're in a different field. And so I sort of was exposed to this, and now probably like 6 or 7 years ago, long time ago, when FSU started a quality enhancement program, which where they do one of these every 10 years. And the theme of this one was critical thinking in the major. And one of the ideas was that we were just trying to encourage all the departments across campus to institute things to assess student critical thinking in their major, okay? And so what I've done here is I've just taken this off the QEP's webpage, there are five major goals. And so I was involved, I was not part of the QEP committee that came up with this, but I was part of a pilot program to do it the first summer. And we used an instrument called the CAT test, which is called just the critical thinking assessment test. And this was a test that was not, it was designed elsewhere. And it was supposed to be a sort of universal test for assessing students' abilities to think critically. And this promoted a huge amount of argument and dissatisfaction amongst people in non-science or social science fields, because the topics are not really specifically science, but they did have to do with usually things that are more closely linked to science than maybe something else. I had to sign a thing saying I would not tell anybody what was on this test, but it was things, they did involve things like showing people a graph, an interpretation of the graph, and things like that. So this, you know, a lot of people were saying, you know, we don't feel that this really is really assessing the types of things that students do for critical thinking in our field. And so as a result, they kind of broadened it. And so they tried to make this list of ideas that should be fairly universal, making them fairly general, so that you know, they could be applied in any situation. So I thought I would mostly just point this out, just because this is something that FSU is trying to promote. At this point, the QEP I think is kind of winding down a bit. Its time period is mostly over. But these are things that that they saw as sort of fairly universal, and that you might want to think about in terms of evaluation. Okay. So what I'm going to do now is try and illustrate some of the things that I've talked about, because you may say he's talked a lot, and talk a little bit about practical applications and get you guys to think a little bit about what we might do. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a very short biology lecture. It's only 5 slides long. And with the idea that when we get done, we will try and identify what the learning objectives of that might have been, and then say like what maybe come up with a question or two that we could ask based on that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you guys about something called tritrophic interactions, which sounds very super technical, but I did pick this topic for a couple of reasons. One is because I was talking about it in one of my classes, and so I had slides handy, so it was easy to do, but it's also something I think is relatively easy to understand. You don't need a lot of technical background to understand what's going on, and it might be kind of interesting. Okay, so just be prepared for the next, 5 minutes or so to, learn a bunch of biology, okay? So tritrophic refers to three, tri is tree, and trophic just means eating, okay? And so it refers to the fact when you're looking at a group of species that are what are called three different trophic levels. So we have a plant down here at the bottom. That's the first trophic level. This is making food through photosynthesis. The second trophic level are, in this case, insects eating the plant. And the third trophic level are other insects that are feeding on the plant eating insects. So that's really all we need to know here. And these are what we call them, a plant and herbivore. And for some reason in entomology, the third trophic level is called natural enemies. That's kind of an idiosyncratic thing. Not really sure why. Okay. All right, so I'll just give you some examples of this so you get a feel for real life biology. So we have leaves of two different plants here. So these round things here are actually growths that the plant has made. And then there is a larval insect inside that. That's called a gall. And this is a case where the insect has actually manipulated the plant chemically to grow these as like homes for its larvae, its babies, basically. And so those galls represent the herbivore stage. And this little wasp here is a parasite that is gonna insert that long thing at the back there into the gall and lay eggs on the larval insects inside. And its larvae will eat those larvae. So that's the three different trophic levels here. This diagram is just two of them. Here's a leaf, and this pattern here is called by caused by a leaf mining insect. That's basically a little tiny larva that's burrowing its way through the inside of the leaf. So this slide is really just to give you some examples of that, of the three trophic levels. So when we talk about effects, so why are we interested in this? So I've sort of told you what this is. We're interested in this because we're interested in how species interact with each other can affect the entire system, and how one species interacting with another species can affect that second species. Okay, and so this is giving you just general ways this can happen. So here we have what's called a bottom-up effect. I've moved from talking about insects and plants now to talking about the ocean. It's the same basic idea. I've also added a fourth trophic level here. So imagine in this situation, it gets cold, the ocean gets colder, and the phytoplankton, which are just algae, this is algae is floating in the water, its population goes down. That's what this sloping line means. The population goes down. And as a result, the organisms eating the algae, their populations go down. The organisms eating those organisms, these little fish here, their populations go down. And the things up at the top, their populations go down. So this is what's called a bottom-up effect. You have something that affects the bottom of the system here, and its effects, in some sense, cascade upwards, okay? And you can also have a top-down effect. So imagine in this case that these large fish are being overfished. as a result of the fishing, it drives these other animals away. And so basically these larger fish and seals and birds and things that are at the top are become less common, okay? As a result, these smaller fish become more common. That causes the animal plankton here to become less common and the plant plankton becomes more common, okay? Don't really worry too much about the details of this. Just the idea here is that you can have a top-down effect and a bottom-up effect, okay? All right, and then I just have one slide left, okay? Which is just showing you this really, now that I've given you a sort of a very basic introduction to this, one of the cool things that's been discovered in the last 20, 30 years is that plants can play a more dynamic role in this than people had thought. So usually people think about, well, the plants get eaten or they don't get eaten. Okay, that's that much, not much a plant can actually do about it. But what's been discovered is that plants actually release these chemicals, which I'm just gonna call HIPPVs. The volatile just means that these are chemicals that are released into the air and can spread through the air, and they're caused by the plant being eaten. So the herbivore-induced plant volatiles just mean insects eat the plant releases these chemicals. And this is not just a result of damage to the leaves or something. This is something that the plant does as a sort of deliberate response to the insect eating the plants. And these chemical signals then attract a range of other insects that could prey on the herbivores, okay? So they attract things like these wasps or these worms living in the soil to attack the herbivores that live there. So the plants can actually sort of skip over the herbivore trophic level and actually interact with the next one up in order to cause a change in the system, okay? All right, so that's the end of my mini lecture. I just put this up here again. If you were to think about trying to test this, you might think about these things. But what I want to do now, actually I should have put this later, sorry, is think what might have been the learning objectives of my lecture. So what are the things that I want students to take home? So any thoughts? What do you think the most important points were?
I think one of them was the chain, you know, like they are eaten by somebody and then by somebody else.
Right, so the fact that there's this series of changes that can go up or down, okay? Yeah. That one trophic level change that affects the others, everything relates to the others. Okay, so we get the idea of changes. Now I did go through this very quickly, but here's what I came up with as the things that I wanted people to take away from this. So tritrophic refers to interactions, and see, now I can see immediately that number two, I forgot to really emphasize. and I didn't really mention number four either. So I immediately can see now, because I came up with this list, that I talked to you very nicely about one, three, and five, but I forgot two and four, because I was doing this kind of in a hurry. So, For example, the learning objectives, one is that just what does this term tritrophic mean? The one that all you guys all sort of catched up on was this idea that effects can cascade up or down. So you can have these effects going up and down. And then plants can produce these HIPPVs. The idea here that I didn't emphasize very well is that interactions can be direct or indirect. So we talked first about the interaction between, you know, the lack of algae would cause the next trophic level up to decline. But then the lack of algae would also cause all the ones higher than that to decline as well. So that would be an indirect effect. But anyways, what I really wanted to point out here is by sort of messing up, I messed up because I didn't really do backwards design here, is that I should have looked at my learning objectives before I started talking, because I really talked about one, three, and five, and I didn't really mention two or four at all, okay? And so then I didn't really get some of the main things that I wanted the students to get. So what I want to do now is just talk a little, use one of these things to think how we can evaluate the students about this. And the one that most of you guys seem to get would be this idea of the fact that these interactions can move up or down the system. And so if I was to ask the students a question to assess this, what kind of question could I ask? Any thoughts? That's exactly, thank you, Angela. So this is the, what Angela pointed out is exactly the sort of question that would get at them understanding this concept. So asking, giving them a situation, what happens to the sharks if the phytoplankton decreases? Or what happens to the phytoplankton if the shark decreases? So if you give them a situation where they have to apply the information, then you can see whether they really understand it or not. Because I could ask them a question like, what is a top-down effect or what is a bottom-up effect? And they can just tell me some words that they learned. But what Angela said was, is the ideal way to do this is to teach them, it's what called, there's a series of levels called Bloom's taxonomy, which many of you may have heard of. So at the bottom level is just factual information. And then there is analysis and application where you ask the students to do increasingly more complex things with the information that they have. And so here you could ask them a question on number three by giving them a situation and say, well, what do you think is going to happen? Okay. And why? Possibly. And so you could ask that as a multiple choice question. You could ask that as a short answer question. Okay. You could also speculate about what might happen in a situation where you released some of this, one of these volatile chemicals in the environment, how that might affect the rate at which plants got eaten by herbivores, for example. You could ask those kinds of things. Okay. All right. I'm going to stop for a second just so I can see how much time I have left. Maybe how much time do I have left, Lisa?
You have a half hour.
A half hour. Okay. I think I can do that. okay. All right. So now let's talk a little bit about low stakes, and I'll talk a little bit about my system and what I do in my class. I'm happy to sort of brainstorm with people about how they might do that in different situations. So low stakes, and I've written costs and benefits. So one of the big ones is try to reduce anxiety and stereotype threat. So I give my students what I call a mini exam every week. And so they're quite anxious about the first couple of them, but then they get kind of used to them, right? And they sort of keep doing them, and then presumably that will reduce the anxiety. But I think equally importantly is that the students get rapid and continuous feedback. So every week they get an exam. It's not very long. They get their grade back basically pretty much instantly. That's one of the advantages of doing things online. And so they can see how they're doing. So for example, today I had a student who emailed me because now we've done two of these and she has not done well on either of them. She knows because I do report on like the average score that this isn't true for the class as a whole. They actually did better on the second one than they did on the first. And so she realizes that she's not doing something right. And so she has contacted me and hopefully I can help her to perform better. This also is an opportunity on my part to see what the students do understand and what they don't understand. Okay. And so this, what I do every week is, and I go into where I've given this, exam on Canvas. I look at the responses for every question. And I can see which questions they did well on, which questions they didn't do well on. And then I go through them. I make a short video in Canvas where I talk about each question. I say this question you guys did fine on. This is the answer. I'm not going to spend much time on it because 95% of the class got it right. This question, only 60% of the class got it right. So I'm going to spend some time explaining why C is the right answer and not A, for example. And then I retest them on the questions that they didn't do well on. I give them new versions of those same questions, okay? So this way, my mini exams are both summative and formative, okay? So they are getting practice answering the questions, so they're learning that way, but I'm also giving them feedback every time on how they're doing. So every week they get feedback on how they're doing, and they also get feedback on which questions they're having problems with, okay? So those I see are the really, the gains of that. Now, obviously, depending on your field, you're probably not gonna give a multiple choice exam every week, but you could think about, how you could play that out within your area. So what are the, I see those as the real gain of doing this sort of low stakes thing is doing something that they do on a very regular basis that sort of builds on itself. And I think it's important to keep something in mind. So the costs are that there's more work for you. So this is more work for me probably over the long run than if I just make a big exam every 4 weeks and give them a big exam and then we move on to a new topic. I still would look at the exam obviously and see who did well and who did right, but I would be writing fewer questions if I did that. So now I'm writing quite a lot of questions and I'll explain to a little bit of one reason why I write so many questions in a few minutes. So there is more work for you. The other thing is that the students have to do things more often. And this is something that is easy to fall in the trap of, is if you do low stakes stuff, that means there has to be more of it, right? And so it's easy to just assign the students so many things that they're drowning in all these small things that they have to do. So, it's really important to be sort of mindful of that. One way I try and minimize that is I have a relatively small number of different kinds of things I have them do, and I have them do on them on a consistent schedule. So generally have them do the same things every week so they get used to like, okay, today's Wednesday, so I have this, and today's Friday, so I have this. How do you account for testing fatigue? So one of the things is that the tests are relatively short. So they don't get asked a lot of questions. So it's not sort of like that they're taking a huge number of different things. And they also, each test is on the material they learned the last week plus the material that they didn't do well on the previous one. So it's a limited amount of stuff they have to prepare for each time, okay? So I think it's not like they're studying everything that they had to learn, which actually... brings me to where I had an indirect experience where someone tried something like this, actually in a fairly similar course to mine, but I think it, because they weren't really mindful of this testing fatigue issue, I think it kind of backfired. So they were very concerned. So this is a course that requires a lot of, there's a lot of factual stuff in it, just a lot of facts that you have to learn. They were saying, oh, the students, they just prepare for the exam. They study really hard. They stick all of this factual material in short-term memory and they forget about it afterwards. And so what they started doing was doing basically a cumulative comprehensive quiz every week. So every week they had to do a quiz where they had to study everything that they covered in the course up to that point and then so on and so on. And what happened, and this all be, and this required a team of graduate students to actually grade these all, because they were all done short answer, not multiple choice. And so the students were having to basically study for a comprehensive exam every week. And eventually they got fed up and complained to the dean as a result. This happened quite a while ago. But so this is an issue. Excellent questions, Angela. Getting accommodations for these weekly quizzes. Do you time them or worry about academic honesty? So I do time them, and I'm going to go through some of the things I do just in a second, if I still have time, just showing you on Canvas what you can do. I basically, any student that has gets extra time on an exam, I give them extra time on quizzes and everything, basically. And then the academic honesty thing, I'll talk a little bit about that as I go through that, okay? So you're doing a great job at sort of previewing what I'm going to talk about next. Okay, so what I'm going to do is basically talk about how I do this in Canvas. So obviously, you can do polls in Canvas or in Zoom, like we just saw. You can also do polls if you want to find out, you know, what the students are. If you have some questions about the students are interested in, they want to, you know, spend more time on something, or you want to work out a schedule or something. And then you can give students written exam, a written assignment, or a lab or something where they would produce a document and upload it. I'm going to focus more on the quiz aspect and just show you a few of the things that I do to try and balance issues of academic honesty and not making the test experience too stressful, especially for students that have, you know, ADA accommodations. Okay, so I'm just going to set up a quiz. So just like this, I would give the quiz, just test quiz one. I would go into the more options thing here in Canvas. So some things you can do to reduce the issues of academic honesty, dishonesty. So one is to shuffle answers so that the students getting the same question A isn't the same answer every time. So they would actually have to pick the right one. So I usually do that for any kind of quiz or test. If it's something that's not really a quiz or test, I don't bother. You can set a time limit. So for my mini exams, I set a time limit that is short enough that they can't just sit there and spend the half the day figuring out what the answers are, but long enough that they shouldn't be too time stressed, okay? So I usually, on the mini exam, I ask as high Bloom's taxonomy, more conceptual questions. I try and write them as very difficult questions because I give them an hour to answer 10 questions. Okay, so it's not a huge, it's not so time rushed that they shouldn't be able to do that. To answer the question about students who have accommodations, that's easy to do in Canvas to give individual students extra time. Okay, for some types of things where I would give them a couple of chances, like I usually do this for assignments that I give them before class to prep for things. There I just expect them to sort of look at the slides and read the text and answer the questions, and so I often give them multiple chances in case they mess up the first time. All right. And now what I want to do is, I'm not even sure why this is in here. Oh yeah, because here are a couple of other things you could do if you're interested. If you're more concerned about honesty, I've never used these myself. You could require an access code to make sure students who aren't part of the class don't sneak in somehow, or only allow certain IP addresses in. I've never done either of those things if you're really concerned about that. What I want to talk about is the last thing I'm going to say is what I do is I write a lot of questions. So again, this is extra time on my part, and I stick them in groups. So this is a really nice function of Canvas, is you could create question groups. So I could create a question group and say, well, I have a particular topic, say the tritrophic interaction topic we just talked about. That's one of the things that's going to be on the mini exam this week. I might write, five or six questions on tritrophic interactions and only use, say, two of those on any given exam, okay? Because then once you've created this group, then when you're actually adding questions to your quiz, you can say add a group. And so here you could call this group one or whatever you could say, and you pick, I could say pick two questions, and the questions would be worth a couple of points each, for example. And then you link to a particular question bank, and then here's some of the question banks I have. I would pick one of those, and then it would randomly for each student pick two of those questions for their mini exam. And this is, you know, it's extra work because I have to write a bunch of questions, right? But it does reduce one of the major problems with academic honesty, which would be students doing this at different times of day and sharing answers. And they can't really do this now because they won't be getting necessarily the same questions. So that's been my approach. That's, I think, basically the end. And so this is just what it looks like. It said group, it would pick some number of questions and it would be pulled from this pool. This is my last slide. So this is all I really had to say. I would be really interested in talking to people for a few minutes about any questions they have about this or how they might apply this to their own field. And I hope this was helpful. I appear to, okay.
Thank you so much. I was having trouble unmuting myself for some reason.
Okay. I was like, okay.
Yeah, okay. I apologize. I'm like, where's my unmute button? Yeah, thank you so much. That was awesome. We appreciate your time. And it looks like some people are saying they would like to stay after.
Yeah, well, at least one person wants to stay and ask a couple questions.
Yeah, since we have blocked till 3:30, you're welcome to.
Yeah.
Okay, it's Angela. I'll jump in, I guess.
Okay.
So thank you for answering all my questions, first of all.
No problem.
But I am curious to know how this impacts your syllabus, your low-stakes philosophy here. Do you, and maybe not so much with online, but, you know, some people will weigh their participation or written assignments a little differently to kind of also add in for more low stakes. Is that something that you do in person or?
So, I mean, I guess I'm not entirely sure exactly what you're asking. So I really started doing this. I had it in mind to do it for a long time. I started doing this as basically as a result of the pandemic and going online last March. And I was like, I am not going to try and give them, you know, a regular exams that are worth, you know, 15% of their grade or something like that each online because, you know, partly because of the academic honesty issue. And then I realized if I did this online using this mechanism, it actually sort of lent itself towards doing this. But to try and answer your question, and if I don't answer your question, feel free to ask again because I may not be understanding it right. I didn't really actually change the weighting of the course as a whole. I think that the amount that is exams is still approximately the same amount it was before. But what I'm doing now is I have a midterm and a final, which are both not worth very much. They're worth approximately twice one of these mini exams. And those are a kind of a mixture of more just factual questions and these more involved questions, because there are a lot more of them. So I don't ask a lot of the really hard questions. And then I have a bunch of these mini exams. And so they're still worth a pretty heavy amount of the grade in the course. It's just that there are a lot more of them. And I think the amount I have for assignments and in-class stuff and things is about the same as it was before. I use this Top Hat system, which is a commercial system for the in-class sort of participation part of the grade. Other than that, I think I'm doing things fairly similarly to the way I was previously.
Okay, yeah, that kind of was my question about the distribution, yeah. The weight of each portion of the course, because that's always something I struggle with, you know, how much weight do I want to give to participation or something to help alleviate the burden of the higher stakes things. So thank you for answering that. And then my second question, and I'll stop, is more about your philosophy on the need for timed exams. I'm curious about that. I've heard arguments on both sides of why we should have things timed and why we shouldn't. And I had a professor of my own who, she let you use your book in your notes and didn't care how long you took, because the point was for you to figure out these answers, and in working through them, you were spending time with the material, you were figuring it out. And so that was her philosophy. And then I have other people who, you know, here's these questions, you either know them or you don't, you have this much time to answer them. And so I've heard this argument about philosophical argument kind of on timing, and wanted to know what your thoughts were.
So I think part of that for me philosophically is the nature of the material. So the course I'm teaching now, which I also taught in the summer, is a diversity of life course. And so a lot of it is kind of purely factual. And that material, and actually that was one of the things I really worked at, was it was actually fairly difficult to write higher Bloom's level, more conceptual questions. And I discovered back in the spring that if I gave them purely factual questions, you know, in an online thing, basically then I would get, you know, 95 or 100% of the students would get them right, because they would just have to look them up. The timing I think is more important in that situation, because you do want the students to have some level of background knowledge so that they don't just look everything up. For things that are more conceptual, I would tend to agree that if you can write questions where they really need to be able to understand something, then even if they don't understand it, then by looking it up, they're going to learn. In that case, I would be less concerned. And that sort of bore itself out. I had, I guess, what I would consider a sort of unplanned experiment, where I was teaching two different courses in the spring when we went online. One of them was evolution, which was a very concept heavy course. You know, it was, you know, things that are often pretty difficult to understand. And then this other course, which is more factual. Okay. And so what I found was that for the evolution course, and at that point I wasn't doing a time limit for these exams, that, you know, I could write really hard questions for that, and it didn't really matter how long I gave them. If they understood it, they understood it and they can answer it. If they didn't understand it, they wouldn't. Giving them a whole day to do it didn't really matter. But for the course I'm teaching now, it did seem to matter, that if I gave them the whole day because so much of it was kind of factual, that then, you know, I would basically get exams where the average would be 97%, which means that I'm not really assessing students' differences in understanding. Well, so that's, I guess, that's kind of my response, is that it depends on what the nature of the material is.
Thank you. So I think I understand, just to home out of that. Sometimes it's okay if your goal is for them to memorize facts, because sometimes that's the goal. And if that's the goal, you can time it and do multiple choice till the cows come home. Yeah. And then sometimes when it's more, you know, applied, is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Basically,
Thank you.
Are there other questions? just scrolling back up to see if there's any questions that I missed. All right, I don't think so.